Levite priest and the wickedness that was there within the Israelites, how they were stealing from each other and really just not behaving like a family ought to, certainly not like a family that has been orchestrated by God, a people known to be his great possession, a people that are inheriting this land after great difficulties by their ancestors, and the Lord's faithfulness to give them this territory. We see them being so heavily influenced by the Canaanites, the original inhabitants of the land, to where they're behaving so similarly you can't really tell the difference between Israelite and Canaanite. We're going to see that behavior continue in the rest of this book. We'll finish out the book of Judges this morning with these three chapters. There is a lot of information, a lot of material here. And my points really are kind of summary points, because it's a lot of storytelling that we'll go through. We really see the sad condition of Israel in these chapters. Chronologically, we talked about excuse me, there being issue, maybe not issue chronologically, but not understanding exactly the time period of when all these things took place. We have a pretty good idea that this was early on, before Samson, before actually the previous story is some ideas and that people have, but nevertheless, we see the deterioration of faith and morality that the Israelites have in this story. I don't envy the teachers of the young kids for this subject, because it's really heavy stuff and really disturbing information. Boy. So let's look at chapter 19. This is, let me bring this up real quick. Reminder that these passages kind of bookend this last section. Now that we've gone through all of the judges, the individuals judging the territories, Judges 17, 6, and Judges 21, 25, both have this exact verse verbatim. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So we see how that is kind of summarized at the beginning of these chapters. Look at verse 1. In those days, there was no king in Israel. So it kind of sets the stage for us. Hey, just a reminder, there's not a line of authority here. Everyone was kind of speaking their own truth, if you will. And we see throughout this chapter just how helpful their moral compass is, and how skewed it really is. There's no king and no concern for the king. If we think of the Lord, certainly there was no authority of a ruler on the land, but they had no concern for the true king. They had no, they gave no answer to the Lord. They ultimately do, but they had no concern for what God had planned for them altogether. We read the story of this Levite who was traveling, and he had this concubine. The concubine is told that she was unfaithful to him, and she fled back to her father's house in Bethlehem of Judah, and she was there for 4 months. So that's in verse 2. And so there's this conflict between the concubine and the Levite. Some translations or some believe that it wasn't actually an affair or unfaithfulness to the marriage, but just an argument. Nevertheless, the concubine was unfaithful and she fled to her father's home. The Levite showed up, and his father-in-law met him there and was really hospitable. And so much so that the Levite said, I'm collecting my wife, collecting my concubine, and we are going to go back. We're gonna leave. And the father-in-law pleaded for him, and he's very hospitable. No, just stay here. Look, kick up your feet. We've got food. We got bread. We'll take care of you, and everything will be all right. And in the morning came, and he's ready to go. And the father-in-law, and even the concubine, kind of say, "Hey, just take your ease. Let's wait till the evening. Let's wait till the afternoon where you can be strong and do this the right way. The night comes, the morning comes, and it's the same kind of story. But he's very hospitable. He tells them to stay. Tells them to stay with him. Verse 5. And on the fourth day, they rose early in the morning, and he prepared to go. But the girl's father said to the son-in-law, strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread, and after that you may go. So the two of them sat and ate and drank together, and the girl's father said to them, be pleased and spend the night, and let your heart be merry. He goes on and keeps him there. So they both ate and drank, verse 8, now verse 9. And when the man and his concubine and his servant rose up to depart his father-in-law, the girl's father said to him, behold, now the day is waned toward evening. Please spend the night. Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here. Let your heart be merry, and tomorrow you shall rise early in the morning for your journey and go. But the man would not spend the night. He rose up and departed and arrived opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. We see that he is encouraged to stay, encouraged to stay there, but he really wanted to get going. So they left. We just read there in verse 10 that the morning had come and gone. It was probably midday afternoon now, and they headed to depart toward Jebus, which is Jerusalem. Continuing in the story, any comments so far? A lot of it's, like I said, a lot of just kind of information. We don't really know why the father-in-law told him to stay. Maybe just, hey, my daughter's home, so let's stay here. I would like for you to stay here with me. Anything that you notice about this story so far, or even throughout, we're familiar with this story. Do you notice anything unique about this story? What's identified and what's not? Right, so it didn't take much for the Levite to stick around, Brother Richter said. And he stays around. And what's interesting is we don't have the names of these people. And I think for their sake, they're probably very thankful that we don't know who they are. We don't know their lineage other than their tribes because of the issues that are about to come up. So they're traveling along their way, and night falls, the servant suggests that they stay in Jerusalem. But the Levite didn't want to do that. He didn't want to stay in a city that was Canaanite heavy, such a presence of the Canaanites at the time. Instead, he wanted to keep on going to Gibeah, and or Gibeah, however you want to pronounce it. Look at verse 11 and 12. Let's see if I can get there. Verse 12, and the master said to him, we will not turn aside to a city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeah. So he has intention of doing the right thing, being surrounded by the right people, which is great. He assumes that that's a safe place to go. As they're there, they realize, let's look at verse 20. They see that there's no hospitable place for them to stay. You know, they just left a home where there's nothing but hospitality. Stay here, be with us. And now they're traveling and they have nowhere to go. You know, there are no hotels, there's no Red Roof Inn, there's no comfort suites, there's nothing to go to, and they have nowhere to go. And so they decide, well, we're going to sleep in the open quarters, the public quarter corners, which apparently was customary for things to do where people didn't have a place to stay. And along comes an older traveler, laborer from Ephraim, and he offers them to stay with his house while he is there in Gibeah. We can assume he's just traveling for work, or at least he's not originally from the area, being from Ephraim. He offers them a place to stay. Look at verse 20. The old man said, peace be with you, or shalom. I will care for all your wants, only do not spend the night in the square. So he brought him into the house and gave the donkeys feed, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. So they find a safe place to stay. Little did they know how valuable that place was. We can see here, they were in, here's Gibeah, here's Jerusalem. So they were traveling north, not wanting to stay in Jerusalem. They went to Gibeah, there within the tribe of Benjamin. Just north is Bethel. To the east is Mizpah. We'll talk about those areas here in just a moment, as well as Shiloh and Jabesh-Gilead. So continuing, we get into the meat of this difficult story to tell and to hear. So they're there at the man's house. They are eating and drinking, and they are making merry in their hearts, is what the scripture says. Not entirely sure what that means. Does anyone have another translation of that in verse 22? As they were making their hearts merry. I've heard where some people think that may be some intoxication there. Not sure. But nevertheless, they're comfortable. They're at ease. They feel good. Life is good. They're having a good night. And then worthless men, worthless fellows, what the ESV says, surrounded the house. This is still in verse 22. Beating on the door. And they said to the old man, to the master of the house, bring out the man who came into your house that we may know him. They are surrounded by these wicked men, these worthless men. We read in other passages prior to this story within Judges of men who were worthless men. Same adjectives described of Samuel's sons, actually in Samuel. And we hear about that of other men, worthless men. I'd hate to be categorized with the same adjective of worthless as these men are. These worthless men come and demand for these visitors that came to Gibeah, and they want to know these men. And I think we know what that means. There's some homosexual behaviors there that they are demanding to happen. This is a almost verbatim situation that happens back in Genesis 19. When Sodom and Gomorrah, remember the men of God come to Lot's house, and Lot greets them and lets them stay in his home. And the very same thing, the men of Sodom come and bang on the door, and the angels or the men of God strike them with blindness. But Lot said the same thing, leave them alone. Don't do this. Don't do this wicked thing. And this is what the old man says. He says, don't do this wicked thing. He pleads for them. He says, don't do this, leave them alone, but I'll tell you what, I'll negotiate with you. In just a terrible way of negotiating, awful way of negotiating. He says, he does have this concubine, and I have my virgin daughter. And he offers them instead. It's really sickening. It makes your heart drop. But that was the alternative that he came up with. Remember, you know, what's the last verse of the book say? 21 verse 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. This seemed like the right thing to do. There's a Levite there, but he didn't talk to the Lord. There was no please Lord intervene. There's nothing there, but they did what was right in their own eyes. So they offer up this concubine that once ran off and stayed home for 4 months and now has been on this journey. And this virgin daughter, I have an asterisk there. We know a virgin daughter, we know that they were married and started having children early compared to our society. This virgin daughter implies a lot, that this could have been a very young little girl. It's a pretty graphic scene and hard to stomach. So this, remember, this is supposed to be a safe place. This is where the Levite wanted to go. He didn't want to stay in Jerusalem. He wanted to keep on going to Gibeah. He mentions that back just a few verses ago. Yeah, there's no level of respect here for the women. I mean, treated like currency. I mean, in this situation, let's pay you off and let's make a trade. Here, you can have these women. And we see how low they were in their eyes, on their moral compass. and to the New Testament, how Jesus really changes that perspective, how wonderful that is. But right, and we see here in just a few minutes after the night how the Levite treats the concubine even after all this. So right, Brother Richter mentions the how low they treated their women. And again, yeah, right. That's right. Doug mentions this is just as old as that, just as the story is the same as Lot's story. The value of women there is considered equal here. Lot offers his two daughters. Please don't violate these men. Just take my daughters. Yes, yeah, Cameron.
You know, you reference Genesis. Even today, Sodom and Gomorrah, now has, you know, that is the most wicked cities, you know, everyone thinks of. And I think the point of this is it's basically the same storyline, but now it's in Israel. And it's exactly showing how far they have gone. And they have gotten to the point that in Israel, they are just as wicked as Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah, good point. I think the other men have said it in a different way, but Cameron just put it into words that what was once the epitome of evil and wicked place to be was Sodom and Gomorrah. We can say that now to people of the world. You know, look at sodomy. Look at we can say Sodom and Gomorrah. And people know that's the worst of the worst. That's just where the worst people are. And now the children of the Lord are equated with the same type of behavior. Not only that, but this Levite thought this is going to be a good place to stay. That was far from the case. And I've already mentioned this, just highlighting that there's no regard for the king, the Lord, and they did what... Remember, this is all what they think this is the right thing to do. And we can remember that for ourselves. If we don't have the true standard, true compass, and we think, this seems like the right thing to do. Look what ends up when we think this is the right thing to do. You know, the end of our good intentions could not be further from what the Lord has in mind for us. So continuing in 27 through 30. So after all this happens, this terrible act, the men violate this woman, which would have been the man, but they offered up this concubine. After all this, the concubine is just tortured through the night and is discovered at the threshold of the home early in the morning, and the master comes out to the door, and he's ready to take her home. Let's look at verse 27 and 28. And the master rose in the morning, and he went. And the master rose up in the morning, and when he opened the doors of the house, and went out to go on his way, behold, there was a concubine lying at the door of the house, with her hand on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up. Let us be going." But there was no answer. Then he put her on the donkey, and the man rose up and went his way home. We, like Brother Richter and Doug mentioned, how worthless they treated women was so low, and now just saying, we just delivered you to the lions, and you just come on, let's go. Here we go. Get up in the morning. Let's get going. And there she is, you know, outstretched hand to the threshold of the house, and she's dead. And he loads her up on the donkey and begins his trek back home. Then there's something unique to us, but a message that would be understood back in that time. We see references of some of this in other passages. The Levite then gets home and begins to dismember the young lady and divides her up into 12 pieces and sends her out as male. And this is a message to the rest of the tribes in Israel. We see in Exodus 29, this is the same kind of language used when separating an animal for sacrifice. So interesting fact there. In 1 Samuel 11 and verse 7, I'm going to read that real quick. I meant to have that marked. for Samuel 11, 7. He took a yoke of oxen. So this is Saul. He took a yoke of oxen, cut them into pieces, and sent them throughout all the territory of Israel by the hand of the messenger, saying, whoever does not come out after Saul and Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen. So we see this is something that was practiced. As gruesome as it is, this is something they understood as a very bold message. Also, remember the way, what was in the law for Israelites to be around a dead body. This is a jarring thing, not only to dismember a human, but then to send her out in such a way. This is mention of how horrible it was, mentioned in Hosea 9. This is referenced back as just a jarring, terrible event. So he sends the body as a message. And we see he sends it all throughout the tribe. And he comes to, let's see, he was in Gibeah there, and Benjamin sends him out through the tribe. We continue the story in chapter 20. The people came out from Dan to Beersheba, including, this is verse 1, including the land of Gilead. So let me go back here. Dan to Beersheba, and including the land of Gilead, so this western side of the Jordan. So we're getting the idea. This is using the terminology Dan to Beersheba, giving us the whole scope of the territories. That terminology may be reflecting the northern and southern, even though this would have been before the Danites settled in the Laish up in that territory. So that will be a study in and of itself, but we'll continue on. So just to give the idea, this is the whole area. So they all come together as one unit, minus Benjamin. They all gather at Mizpah. Let me come back here. Here's Mizpah. Okay, so just north of Gibeah. They all come together as one unit, and they meet together. And the Levite told the story of what happened, the story that we just read in chapter 19. He tells this story for the next few verses. And thankfully, the Israelites were disgusted and outraged about what happened. So I have all of Israel was outraged about what happened in Gibeah and demanded Benjamin, I had to abbreviate there, Benjamin to render over the wicked men, but Benjamin refused. So they decided, let's all get together, and we're going to head to Benjamin and demand that these men be sent over to us. This is how devoted they were. In verse 8, all the people arose as one man, saying, none of us will go to his tent, and none of us will return to his house. But now this is what we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against instant by lot, and we will take 10 men of 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, and 100 of thousand, and 1,000 of 10,000 to bring provisions for the people. So what they're doing is they're making a stance. We will not rest, we will not go home until this is taken care of. So they have this really this great zeal to correct this situation. And the story really gets better. It gets quite nice. We see the, at least for the behavior of the Israelites, these 11 tribes. And in verse 18, the people of Israel arose and went up to Bethel and inquired of God, who shall go up first for us to fight against the people of Benjamin? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up first. Why did they go to Bethel? I think I had that question in the slides later, but I'll ask it now. That was a place of worship. What was there? What was there for the Israelites? What was in Bethel? Tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant. So they go to this place. They go to God's presence. And what do they ask? What do they ask the Lord? Who goes up first? Okay, we could note they don't ask, should we? Should we go against our own family? But they ask who goes up first, and he answers, Judah. What does that sound familiar to? When did Judah go first before? Yes, when they went into the land, Judah was to go up first. So we see now in Judah and Judges 1, who's to go first to destroy the Canaanites? Judah. Who's to go first to destroy our own family? Judah. Interesting how the time has changed and how flip-flopped their behavior is. But Judah is still to go first. Lorenzo. Lorenzo mentions, we talk about the cycle. That was the first slide before all this. We talk about the cycle of how the people sin. They cry out for help, for deliverance. A judge is sent. They are repent and they come back. They have a time of peace. He's saying this. We don't really see the cycle here, really. It may be a cycle, but it's a downward spiral. It's a downward spiral is what Lorenzo said. It's just such decline. We should come back to this great resolve of unity and obedience, but we see there may be a type of cycle, but it's really a downward trajectory of behavior and faith. So not only were the judges Judah the first to go first against the Canaanites, but they were the first to go toward Benjamin, attack Benjamin. Where was the concubine from? Do you remember the very beginning of chapter 19? Bethlehem of Judah. She's from Judah. So now that tribe gets to go back and have this vengeance. They get to go first and kind of correct all of this. That's kind of we see maybe that's an intention of God there too, that's orchestrated too. Now the tribe gets to go back and attack the city that killed one of their own. So 11 of the 12 tribes of Israel go to Benjamin, go to Gibeah, and they fight. We have a lot of details, a lot of numbers of deaths and total count, and we understand that Benjamin, they had all these men. A unique fact here that the men were left-handed. Let's see if I can find this. If someone finds that before I do. Verse 16. Yes. So 15. And the people of Benjamin mustered out of their cities on that day 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who mustered 700 chosen men. 16. Among all, these were 700 chosen men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone and at a hair and not miss. And the men of Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 men who drew the sword. All men were men of war. So we've also seen the growth and experience of these Israelites, where they were once ignorant of warfare and were really just slaves that were beat to death coming out of Egypt and now into Canaan. And now they've really developed into a war type of people, so much so they've got 400,000 ready men to fight. So we have this unique note of the Benjamites being left-handed and incredibly accurate with a sling, with a stone. We We get that interesting fact. So we see now they go into day one and Israel is down. They lose this first battle of day one of 22,000 men fall. They go back. They try it again. They cry. They weep out to the, they cry out to the Lord. They go back and then 18,000 of them fail. So they're losing to this much smaller number. And Israel is distraught. They're frustrated. So they went to Bethel to worship. They make sacrifices. They offer up offerings to the Lord. And they cry out to the Lord. They are fasting. And they come in verse 26 and 28. Let's read that here. Then the people of Israel and the whole army went up and came to Bethel and wept. They sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, ministered before it in those days, saying, shall we go out? This is what they asked the Lord. Shall we go out once more to battle against our brothers, the people of Benjamin, or shall we cease? And the Lord said, go up, for tomorrow I will give them into your hand. So they go to Bethel, where this place of worship was, and they fast, and they're really focused on the Lord. And now they ask God, what? What do they ask the Lord? Should we go, or should we retreat? Should we stop doing this? And God says, I will be with you. Not only, he said first in Judah, he didn't say you're going to win, but he says, I'll be with you, and you will have the victory tomorrow. So Israel comes together. You remember, they're one unit. There's a great sense of unity to right this wrong. And, they come up with this familiar strategy of this ambush, and they send out all these men on the backside of Gibeah, and this is just almost identical to Joshua 8:20, where the battle at Ai, where they ambushed the city of Ai. The men run into the city, then they retreat, drawing all the people out. The people from the backside, in this case maybe the north side of the city, go in and start to destroy the city. We see that they destroy the city with fire. Again, referring to Genesis 19, which really that point should have just been here. So they show the sign of destruction with this cloud of smoke as a message for Israel. Okay, now come back. Let's attack and collapse on the Benjamites here. This is the behavior they did in Genesis. And in Genesis 19, very similar language here, and as is Joshua, of this cloud of smoke that went up to heaven. We see the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. They were destroyed the same way. Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed the same way. And we see this eerie, similar behaviors and victories and defeat of this city as was Sodom and Gomorrah. So Benjamin is defeated, and we see that 600 men retreated to the wilderness. They were attacked, and they killed 5,000 of them, but 600 of them got away, and they retreated and stayed alive. Chapter 21 is an interesting regression here, at least mentally for the Israelites. What had Israel as a whole? Sorry, that's a weird typo. What if Israel as a whole had had this zeal back in Judges 1? They were pursuing them so hard to purify that city, to get rid of these Benjamites. What if they had behaved that way throughout the land of Canaan? We would have not have been in this mess at all. They would have really done what the Lord had said. But they were so fired up and had this deal to right this wrong that the Levite told of this story. Here's the big kicker here. 21:1. Now the men of Israel had sworn at Mizpah, no one of us shall give his daughter in marriage to a Benjamin. Not only were they purifying the land, but they're not going to intermarry with Benjamites. They intermarried with Canaanites, and they just started that terrible downward spiral of chaos and disobedience and faithlessness. But they made this vow at Mizpah, at Mizpah to not even have their daughters marry a Benjamite. A few verses on, Israel begins to regret losing this tribe, losing the Benjamites to the great family of Israel. And they're concerned about what's going to happen to Benjamin. We need to restore Benjamin. Remember in Deuteronomy, if a woman does not have a husband, then her brother needs to marry the woman. And, you know, there was laws set in place to preserve a family. And here they've just destroyed a giant tribe of the nation. They realize that Jabesh-Gilead did not come to Mizpah at this rally to overtake Benjamin, and that there were women there. Well, there were 400 women there. They said, we'll take 400 women there to rebuild Benjamin. But that's 200 short. Remember, there were 600 men that got away, 400 women from Jabesh-Gilead. They were still short. They needed 200 women. Here's Jabesh-Gilead here. Mizpah, Gibeah. Okay, got that idea. So Israel develops this plan to save Benjamin. If we look in chapter 21, verse 19. So they said, behold, wait a minute. There is a yearly feast of the Lord at Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem on the south of Lebanon. And they commanded that the people of Benjamin, saying, go and lie in ambush in the vineyards and watch. If the daughters of Shiloh come out to dance in the dances, then come out to the vineyards and snatch each man his wife from the daughters of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin. So they have this really interesting way of courting. It's very a caveman approach. So they go from Jabesh-Gilead to snatch these women when they are, I'm sorry, they had the women at Jabesh-Gilead, but they needed more. So there was this party that happened at Shiloh that was in the land of Canaan. And so what they did, this is an artist's depiction. Well, they go in and they just go and collect a wife. And that seemed right to them. This is right. We inquire to the Lord. We're coming up short, so what else can we do? Let's come up with our own plan. Let's not discuss it with the Lord. So they don't go back on their vow to the Lord of not marrying with the Benjamites, but they're altering it. How can we work around this, though? And the chapter and the book concludes with, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. We see that, God, just for a minute there, they were really purifying and doing the right thing. And they obeyed the Lord. They inquired of the Lord, made offerings to the Lord, but still didn't go through with complete obedience and thought, how can we make this work and still have our family and still do what we want to do? Thank you for your attention. We will start in Ruth, Lord willing, on Wednesday. Thank you.